This is XTP Media.
It's the story, really, of an aircraft that, you know, it's like the typical Fleet Air Arm story of having to work with something that's not ideal and then doing far more with it than anyone ever appreciated.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Takeoff. So, here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 105 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today, I'm joined by Matt Willis, naval aviation historian, to talk about the Supermarine Seafire. Supermarine Seafire is the navalised version of the famous Spitfire, and it was adapted for use on aircraft carriers. 2,646 examples were built, and it saw action with Royal Navy's Fleet Air Arm from November 1942 until after the Korean War. It was involved in combat during the Allied landings in North Africa, the Allied invasion of Sicily and Italy, the D-Day landings, and Operation Dragoon in southern France. With the Pacific Fleet, the Seafire proved capable of intercepting and destroying the Japanese kamikaze attack aircraft. Matt's new book, Fleet Air Arm Legends, The Supermarine Seafire, is out now, and I'll put links to where you can get a copy in the show notes. Supporting the sector in these troubled times, I was prompted by Matt to get my copy from the Navy Wings store. Matt, welcome back to Extended.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
No, it's great to have you back. And we want to talk about the your latest book, Supermarine Seafire, Fleet Air Arm Legends series. Let's start with what's the inspiration behind this writing a book about the Seafire?
Well, the Seafire is, as everyone knows, the naval version of the Supermarine Spitfire. As with all things naval, it's rather less well known, less well appreciated than the famous Spitfire, the land-based version. It's one of a number of naval fighters from the Second World War, which were, which went into service sort of under pressure of wartime conditions. It was not ideal in many ways, so there were lots of interesting stories about how they made it work for naval operations. It's just one of those aircraft that, again, is despite its sort of very famous lineage and its very famous heritage, it's not as well known. It's not very well understood. People don't have such a sense of, obviously, with the Spitfire, you think of the Battle of Britain, and then you think of, you know, right through the war, Malta and D-Day and all those very famous operations, whereas people have less of a sense of what the Seafire did and where it went to battle and things like that. So I think it was just to sort of try and tell that story and to bring that a little bit more to the fore. Morton's Tempest Books imprint is doing this series on Fleet Air Arm Legends, which I think the Seafire is very fittingly the first in that series. So it felt like a good place to start.
Right. Okay. So where did the development of the Seafire version start? What happened to convert it from, as you said, what we recognise as the Spitfire into that shiny thing flying from the carrier decks?
Well, it was a very It was a sort of interrupted process. There were several attempts to try and create a naval version of the Spitfire, or to navalise the Spitfire and going back to the late 1930s, which for whatever reason didn't come off. So there was talk of creating a naval Spitfire from about 1938, and in 1939. There was a new specification for a naval fighter, specification N839, which really was for a replacement for the Skua. So they were looking for something that was sort of similar but higher performance. And then as the war started and we sort of started to get into the first few months of war, it became obvious that actually what the Fleet Air Arm needed was not something like a higher performance skewer. It needed something that actually had much higher performance, and that it was going to be fighting land-based enemy aircraft more. So they started adjusting the specification. And Supermarines at this point, they had been working on a new separate design for a two-seater aircraft that was really something like a Fulmer. But when the Admiralty started adjusting the terms of the specification to require more out-and-out performance, they thought, well, we have our very high-performance Spitfire. Why don't we, rather than create something that's good for deck landing and try and make it high-performance, why don't we take this high-performance aircraft and try and fit it for deck landing, which was the opposite way that the problem had been approached before. So they created this naval version of the Sea Spitfire, which was quite different to how the Seafire later turned out. It was much more of a major adaptation of the airframe. So it had slightly different wings. It had sort of wings that were a bit shorter span, but broader chord. And they folded back along the fuselage the way, like similar to a Ferry Firefly. Rather than how the American style of wing fold that the Seafire later had, where they just fold directly upwards. And it had the radiators were moved. The wings, rather than being straight, they had a sort of cranked wing, which enabled them to shorten the undercarriage. And so they were very, and it had a Griffin engine. So this was one of the first instances of the Griffin engine, the larger Rolls-Royce engine, being considered for a Spitfire variant. And this was sort of very late 1939, very early 1940. But that didn't go anywhere. It was the Admiralty took a good look at it. They felt that it was an interesting suggestion. It had good technical characteristics, but for various reasons they favoured a slightly different aircraft, and in the end went for something that would evolve over a long process into the Fairey Firefly. So that was the first attempt to create a naval version of the Spitfire, which didn't really work out, but it had put the idea in various people's heads. That there should be a naval Spitfire. So later on, again, when particularly with the Norwegian campaign and then early on into the Mediterranean, by this time the Fleet Air Arm realized actually they really did need a very high performance aircraft, more of a point defense interceptor. Naval fighters up until that point had focused on long range, so they needed to have a good endurance to be able to escort strike missions long over the sea, and also to be able to navigate long distances. So they tend to favor having a second person in there so you can navigate. At the time, the Fleet Air Arm didn't really consider that it was possible for a single-seater to navigate for long distances over the sea, although the technology was changing that pretty soon would allow this to happen. And so by this stage, as you're getting through into 1940, they're starting to realise that the aircraft they've got are inadequate. What the first attempt they make to try and rectify this situation is by buying aircraft from America. So the Grumman Martlet, which will later become the Grumman Wildcat, is the favored aircraft. This is the single seater, which very tough, pretty good performance, Very good in a deck landing environment, and particularly when the Fleet Air Arm get a folding wing version, this is the aircraft that they really want.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, America also wants it, and they're rearming, the US Navy's rearming, they're building up, they're getting to starting to get into the sense that they might need to be there, they might be in a war sooner rather than later. So they allow Britain to have a couple of hundred martlets, and then they turn the taps off. So by right. this time, late 1941, the Fleet Air Arm's really in trouble. They're starting to get some old Sea Hurricanes, old battered Hurricane Mark I's from the RAF, which the RAF grudgingly allows them to have, and they make a minimal conversion with a hook and some catapult spools, and then put it on an aircraft, you know, a few bits of equipment, naval equipment, and then they put it on an aircraft carrier and call it a Sea Hurricane. Yeah. But those aren't really ideal either for various reasons. What they really need is a high-performance aircraft that can go toe-to-toe with the best land-based fighter aircraft. And just about the only option in the British armoury now is the Spitfire. So by this time, Churchill has got involved. He's been to visit HMS Indomitable, new aircraft carrier, and is horrified to find out that what they have in their air group for fighter aircraft is old Mark I Hurricanes, which were the same aircraft that he was watching fighting the Battle of Britain a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And in some cases, these are actual airframes that were in the Battle of Britain. Famously, one of them had been one of the Hurricanes that was given to the Royal Navy was had been shot down twice and repaired and put back into service and given to the Navy. But anyway, I'm getting off track. So at this point, Churchill says we need absolutely the best fighters for the Fleet Air Arm, this means the Spitfire. So the RAF starts transferring. Initially, 48 Spitfire Mark V's are transferred to the Navy, and they're delivered to a company called Air Service Training at Hamble. And their job is to convert the Spitfire for naval operations and to make it fit for aircraft carrier use. Around a little bit before this time, they've decided to call it the Sea Fire because quite wisely they decided that Sea Spitfire was a bit of a mouthful. So we're just about getting into the first Sea Fires, really at the beginning of 1941.
And Matt, you mentioned earlier the need for the Navy to have a bit of a longer range fighter interceptor, but also there's the war's changing, isn't it? Mm-hmm, the defence mm-hmm. of the UK was the priority in terms of the immediacy of the need for aircraft, and now we're starting to see the war change where the Allies are looking to strike. The use of carriers is coming more into play in terms of Britain stretching itself to other battle theatres. Does this also drive Churchill's passion for getting better strike aircraft?
Yeah, very much so. And this is very much the change, as you say, the changing cast of the war. The fact that the Allies are no longer quite so much on the defensive; they're looking to really take the war to the enemy in various theatres. And this also really does drive the equipment of the Sea Fire to the Fleet Air Arm, because
right.
the first major operation that. That they're really starting to gear up for and start to need a lot of high-performance aircraft is Operation Torch, which is the invasion of Axis North Africa, particularly French North Africa, which is the Vichy regime, which is the French government allied to Nazi Germany, holds this territory in North Africa, and this is felt to be a first way of the Allies getting a foothold into enemy territory. There they can kind of change the nature of the war in North Africa really start sort of pushing back the enemy in the Mediterranean theatre and starting to look at going back into Europe. So November 1942 is when Operation Hot Torch happens. So before this, for the couple of months before this, we've had the major operations in the Med have been the Malta convoys, trying to push the supplies through to Malta to safeguard Malta and to safeguard it just from falling to enemy invasion, but also to keep it there as a strike base. And it was during these Malta convoys that it was realized that the aircraft that they had were only barely adequate. So the Sea Hurricanes, the older Sea Hurricanes with their 303 machine gun armament, they did the job, but you know, it was touch and go.
Yeah.
And the Fulmers at the time, which really were by now struggling, you know, they had a top speed of somewhat under 300 miles per hour. They had a long climb. They didn't climb to height very quickly. And the Fulmer by now was not adequate as a frontline fighter. So all this was driving the need to really get the Seafire into operation and to, you know, build it there in large numbers. Obviously, the modern Spitfires that they had now were all cannon armed. They were certainly as good as anything that the Axis had in the Mediterranean. So, as a dogfighter, an interceptor, there were various other issues which I imagine we'll get to. But in the air, they were as good as it got. So this was the important thing, and they thought that with the invasion of North Africa, they had to allow for the fact that the opposition to the invasion of North Africa might be every bit as concerted as it was for the Malta convoys, which were really, really hard fought. They had, you know, huge opposition from Luftwaffe aircraft in Sicily and from the other islands in the other islands in the Mediterranean, and they were fighting those convoys every step of the way. And they really thought that this was probably they had to be able to counter a force like that when they were going into North Africa. So that was the thinking behind getting the Seafires, as many of them as possible, into that theatre.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Let's just talk a bit about performance and power plant before we talk a bit more about where we saw the Seafire operate. One of the views about the Seafire was its operation from carriers, and its original design, of course, was not to be thrown around a very small space and with the pressures of catapult takeoffs, with landing hooks and arrestor hooks putting pressure on the airframe. How was it designed to respond with that? Because there's lots of stories and anecdotal stuff about the undercarriage being too weak and it being so underdesigned as a naval aircraft.
Yeah, I mean, certainly from the very start, there were lots of issues with trying to make the Spitfire into a carrier-capable aircraft. And if it hadn't been for the pressures that they were under, I don't think they would have tried, because, or certainly not without a major redesign. But in terms of trying to adapt existing Spitfires to carrier capability, that was not ideal by any means. So, I mean, you mentioned the undercarriage. That was a factor. It was designed to be adequate for big, wide grass aerodromes where you can always land into wind. You've always got plenty of space, I mean, the Spitfire, for various reasons, when it was being designed, had quite a large wing, quite a low wing loading. So you invariably get this situation where when you're landing, you've got a, you know, the thing floats. It sort of, it sits in the ground effect. And actually, you know, it takes quite a lot of space to get the wheels on the ground. It, you know, it had quite a bouncy undercarriage, which was, you know, we've all seen the film Battle of Britain, where the Tyro pilot comes in with his Spitfire and boomps a daisy, it's enough to make you weep. You know, bounce, bounce, bounce. You know, it's easy to do that with a Spitfire for various reasons, and that was obviously that's the last thing you want when you're trying to put an aircraft down on an aircraft carrier. You don't have a lot of space. You really need a situation where you need it to get over the wires and then drop like a brick, which is the one thing that the Seafire couldn't do. Then you had this undercarriage that was adequate for being, you know, for being greased onto a long aerodrome with lots of space and being put down softly, softly, softly. It's not fit for being dropped from several feet. And then bouncing back on that, so there were problems. There were problems that the undercarriage would break when it hit the deck too hard. There were problems that if it didn't hit too hard but bounced, then it would bounce the aircraft over the wires and into the barrier, or even over the barrier. And there are, you know, situations where the aircraft kind of bounced all the way over the barrier and into the parked aircraft forward. So that was not ideal. Then, you know, you had things like it had a long nose, quite a wide nose, very poor visibility forward. So they had to develop whole new techniques to actually approach the carrier, because if you approached in the normal way, you couldn't see it. The nose was blanking out the entire aircraft carrier in front of you.
Yeah.
So they would develop this, very tight curving approach where you can see, you can see the carrier, and also, you know, you've got it gets to the point where you've got this wing out in front of you. The cockpit on the Spitfire is quite far back. So, you know, if you're coming in slightly sideways, then the wing will blank it if the nose isn't.
Yeah.
So you have to come in quite a steep bank, keep the carrier in view, keep the batsman in view, because you've got the batsman giving you instructions as to whether you're on the right approach or not. So they had to develop this curving approach, or there was an alternative which Winkle Brown favored, which was to sort of unbalance the aircraft and fly slightly sideways, which, you know, took some skill to do. But, you know, Winkle Brown, no one more skilled than him. So you could actually tilt the aircraft and kind of balance the aerodynamics, so you were flying it slightly sideways and actually looking past the nose rather than over the nose, and then kick the thing straight just as you're about to put it on the deck. So there are all these kinds of techniques and tactics that they needed to do. They did strengthen the airframe somewhat. There were various bits bolted to it to try and stop it breaking when they put it on the deck. But it really was kind of, certainly the early marks were a very minimal conversion of the Spitfire to try and use it from a carrier deck. And as such, they came with a lot of problems that had to be tried and mitigated through the way that the aircraft was used.
Yeah. And you mentioned the Griffin. What other power plants were used in the Seafire?
The early Seafires used the same sort of power plants as the Spitfire Mark V. So the Merlin 45 was the first one. They then started to focus on low-level versions of the Merlin, to use the aircraft at low level. So it was, again, naval air combat. Most of the combat tends to be at a lower level than it does with the RAF. So at the time, the RAF was moving towards higher and higher altitude. So if you bring these aircraft, which have their high altitude optimized Merlins, then they're not ideal. So there was an early mark called the 2C, and then they developed a low-level version called the L2C, which had the Merlin 32, which you'll recognise as the engine from the Fairey Barracuda Mark II.
Yeah.
And they did actually nick supplies for Barracudas from to put them in Seafires. So this was yet another reason for delaying the poor old Barracuda. It gets all its engines nicked for the Seafire. So this was a real hot rod. The L2C was a, it didn't have the folding wings, so it still had quite a lightweight structure. And it had this engine which put out a lot of, 1600 plus horsepower at deck level. You know, it was a real hot rod, low level interceptor. The Griffin, they started putting it in. There were developments for the Griffin, because the Griffin was originally meant to be a naval engine. The Admiralty commissioned it. It was never meant to be for RAF aircraft, but of course, again, wartime service, the Fleet Air Arm being the Cinderella service somewhat, they get their engines taken by the RAF, and they have their this very effective larger V12, which goes, but the later on, the Fleet Air Arm does start to get some of these back. And the C5 Mark 15, which is arriving just towards the end of the war, sort of, it's being tested in late 44. It's coming into service in 45, which has the short single-stage supercharged Griffin, Griffin 15. No, sorry, it's a Mark 15. Sorry, I can't remember off the top of my head which Griffin is. It's a Griffin 2 or something like that.
Yeah.
Which again is a low-level optimized engine. Gives more power. It's generally a. But then, again, you've got the issues of you're putting a slightly bigger, heavier engine into a lightweight, small airframe. So that variant has its problems when it comes in.
And how did the Fleet Air Arm pilots respond to the Seafire? What are the reports of how it flew and did they enjoy flying it?
Yeah, I think generally the impression was that it was a delightful aircraft to fly, but a horrible aircraft to try and land.
right.
So you had mostly people did really appreciate it. Its aerial qualities, particularly if they were coming from things like Fulmers, which were a bit ponderous by this stage. On the other hand, if you had people who were used to things like martlets, where you could just drop it on the deck from any height and it would take it and it would catch a hook and it would keep running straight, suddenly you found that you had this very kind of sensitive, flighty racehorse kind of machine that if you looked at it wrong, it would throw you over the side of the carrier, or it would break, or it would it would bounce you into the air and throw you into the parked aircraft. So I think that tended to be the consensus of opinion. Some pilots got on with it and would they would put up with its faults. Other pilots, I think, were potentially a bit scared by it. So it is a variation. It was, and I think there were lots of kind of comic songs written about how difficult it was to land, and how it would sort of you'd try and do one thing on the landing approach and it would do another, and it was the typical Fleet Air Arm pilots, where they accepted that what the equipment they were getting wasn't ideal. And they would sort of try and make a joke of it, and there was a bit of black humor about it, and but I think they did generally appreciate its aerial qualities.
So where did we see the Seafire in action, Matt? It was in operation for over a decade, wasn't it? So, and it did travel well.
Yeah, I mean, for an aircraft that was really just a sort of intended as a short-term fix, because there was nothing more suitable available, and it was a very rapid conversion. But I hesitate to say bodge job, but it was done as quickly as it practically could be. It did then stay in service for a long time, and was a sort of mainstay of the Fleet Air Arm, not just through the end of the war, but also into the post-war period. So as I mentioned before, North Africa, Operation Torch was the first time it was used, and it had its first air-to-air kills in that operation. The next big operation that it took part in then was the invasion of Sicily, and then really the first time where it was used in large numbers was the invasion of mainland Italy with Operation Avalanche in September 43. And this was where it was again, some of those problems really came to light. and they started sort of having to find ways of operating it. There were a lot of aircraft broken. They were expecting that they would have, you know, 1 or maybe 2 days operating from carriers close to the shore, and then they would be able to go and operate from land-based aerodromes. But in the end, they were sort of, you know, over a week trying to operate from the carriers, and they lost something like, they lost almost half the aircraft. So that was a problem. But then thereafter, it was used. It continued to be used in the Mediterranean sort of throughout the mopping up of that campaign. So into the Greek islands, where they started using it as a dive bomber, interestingly enough. And then the invasion of southern France in Operation Dragoon, which was a little bit after D-Day itself. There were some C-5s used at D-Day where they were actually, adapting the aircraft for different purposes. They were actually used for gunnery spotting. Okay. So you had pilots flying C-5s who were actually spotting the fall of shot for naval warships. And there you also had some US Air Force pilots, some US Navy pilots, I should say, flying the Seafire.
Yeah.
Because their aircraft were sort of not really fit for the battle space. They were sort of flying these float planes. So they were converted onto Spitfires just before the battle. And then the Spitfires and Seafires were pooled. So any aircraft trained on those types would end up flying Seafire or a Spitfire. So you had US Navy pilots flying the Seafires as well and doing that gunnery spotting mission, which was quite an interesting adaptation of a single seat interceptor. And then from thereafter, really, it was into the they did a little bit in the North Sea, but it was mainly into the East. So the East Indies, and then particularly into the Pacific.
Yeah, that seems to be where I seem to recognise its use more. I was quite surprised how much it was used in the European campaign.
Yeah, I mean, that's less well known. It's sort of, they were used a little bit on the escort carriers, and then it got to the point where they realised that they were just too fragile for escort carrier use. But they were used in the Northern European theatre. They were operating from HMS Furious during those same missions when the Barracudas and later Avengers were doing their sort of anti-shipping harassment strikes on the sort of German coastal shipping down that way. And as I say, they stayed in Europe really until sort of 1945, until the surrender of Germany, really, and they continue to be used in that theatre sort of long after. Yeah, we tend to think of the Fleet Air Arm moving out east at that point and doing the move into the Pacific. But yeah, they did stay in Europe and were continue to be used well and used effectively in that theatre.
Right, okay. And any notable action or kills down to the Seafire? Any particular stories that come out in the book?
There's lots of air combat which sort of goes through from those early Mediterranean operations into the Pacific, where the major issue they're fighting is the kamikaze. So the British Pacific Fleet is sailing to various Japanese held islands where kamikazes are operating from, and you have the Avengers and Fireflies taking the fight to those islands and trying to destroy the airfields and sort of render them unusable. But at the time the Seafires are then, they have to stay with the fleet and deal with the kamikazes that are coming at them.
Yeah.
They start to develop the tactics. They have some good success. Then there are a couple of incidences where, really through a sort of mix up with organisation, a few kamikazes get through, and the Seafires are unable to stop them. And that's that leads to then a few some serious damage to some of the Fleet Air Arm carriers, which is then all kind of, it's a difficult learning process that they're trying to work out how to deal with these, attacks coming from different directions with very little warning, and the Seafire, which has great low-level acceleration, is a good kind of, it's the last point of defense before the anti-aircraft guns on the ships themselves, really. So they do have some success, but they're learning all the time.
And as I mentioned, it was in Navy service for about 10 years. Did it serve at all in Korea?
Yeah, when the Korean War broke out, the carrier that was in Eastern waters at the time was HMS Triumph, which had a slightly older air group. At the time, the Fleet Air Arm was starting to kit out its light fleet carriers with an air group of Firefly Mark Fives and Sea Furies. But the slightly older aircraft, so the Seafire 47s and the Firefly Mark Ones, Triumph happened to still have those in its air group when it was in the East and the war broke out. So Triumph immediately had to go on station, operate with the task force, its Seafires, which were 800 squadron, were then operating as fleet defense. They were doing some patrols, they were doing photo reconnaissance, and they were doing some of the shorter range strike missions. Some of the sort of range deficiency of the Seafire had been dealt with sort of in the Pacific War, basically by putting larger and larger drop tanks on. Lieutenant Commander Mike Crossley, who wrote that really wonderful book, They Gave Me a Seafire, about his experiences in the Fleet Air Arm. So he was responsible for finding a big shipment of P-40 large capacity drop tanks. And once they brought these over and fitted them to Seafires, they realised that actually you could go quite a long way in a Seafire, and they would haul this big under fuselage drop tanks. So some of the range considerations of the Seafire had been addressed by the time they got to Korea, and they had big underwing drop tanks that fit flush to the undersurface of the wing, and a big under fuselage one as well. So they could go and do missions over land, which was only really something that was done right at the end of the Second World War. So the Seafire was the first fighter on station in the Korean War. Again, they were used quite effectively, but they still had the old problems of the deck landing was still a bit of an issue. All the work they've managed to do on the Seafire over this time, it was still a bit of a fundamental flaw, and they did find themselves losing quite a few Seafires through deck landing accidents. They were operating in quite hostile conditions at this stage. They were permanently on station. They didn't have much in the way of supply. Relatively, they did have, HMS Unicorn did eventually come out with a resupply of Seafires, but it got to the point where the Far East Fleet's supplies in Hong Kong started to run down, and they didn't have many spare airframes or engines or the various bits and pieces to repair the aircraft. So after that that first deployment, that was it for the Seafire. But they'd been first on station. They'd been the ones who'd sort of been blooded first, and they were, really in 1950, into that decade after the Second World War, they were fighting a second major war, which was sort of quite an achievement for what was originally intended as a stopgap.
Still to come on Extended.
The differences between flying a Seafire and a Sea Fury. So he's flown the Kennet Aviation Seafire Mark 15. And so getting his insights into what those two aircraft are like to fly and how they compare with each other was really good.
Are you fascinated by aviation and its history? Are you hungry to expand your knowledge? Then you're ready for The Aviation Historian. A compact format quarterly journal, The Aviation Historian is a cross between a magazine and a book. It uses the best authors and the best picture sources to explore the less well-known paths of the history of flying. It's created by experienced, award-winning former Aeroplane magazine editors Mick Ogee, that's me, and Nick Stroud, so you can trust it for quality, accuracy, and sheer passion for the subject. The Aviation Historian. We're print, we're digital, but we're not in the shops. order us online and find out more at theaviationhistorian.com. Are you ready for it?
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
And did it serve with any other air arms, or was it only the fleet air arm?
Yeah, I mean, C-fires went to various other air arms. So some of them were using them as land-based aircraft. So the Republic of Ireland had a shipment of C-fires, which they only operated from land, which they didn't have an aircraft carrier. The French, the Aéronavale, used C-fires. They initially had a shipment of C-fires, which they used fairly briefly. They were sort of used initially to build up the French fleet air arm, but they started to phase those out and replace them with things like Hellcats quite quickly. There were various sort of air arms out in the Far East that used C-fires, again mainly in a land-based role. So they did see a bit of service with foreign air arms after the Second World War, but they were less favoured for those for that purpose, and they didn't have quite such a good export rate as things like the Firefly, which was quite popular, and then obviously when they came into competition with American types, which were very robust and very very well suited to carrier operations, and obviously the Americans were kind of with a hard sell about pushing their products at the time as well. They tended to get they had a fairly short combat or service career with some of those overseas air arms, but they did see some use.
So the book Fleet Air Arm Legends, starting with the Supermarine Seafire, is now out. How did you do the research on this? Was this one of those challenging ones? Was there much material that you could harvest on for the book?
I mean, actually, it was one of the books where the difficulty is keeping it down rather than I could have quite easily written twice as much without too much struggle. So there was a certain amount of archive research. There was there's a lot of interesting stuff in the National Archives at Kew and at the Fleet Air Arm Museum. There's a lot of documents about particularly how they were developed and brought into service, which is sort of quite a fascinating story, which was a bit of the story I wanted to tell, which hadn't quite been focused on so much before. People tend to start the story at the point where we need the Seafire in sort of getting into 1941, and it's brought into service, but those slightly earlier faltering attempts were a little bit more I found that interesting to tell that bit of the story as well. I was lucky enough to I'd been sent a little while ago by a lieutenant commander Baldwin, who was really one of the sort of he was one of the leading lights of Seafire operations, who'd flown Seafires from escort carriers, and then from during Operation Torch, Operation Avalanche, and he sent me an unpublished memoir which he'd written for his children and grandchildren. So that was really an interesting insight into operating the Seafire, which was otherwise unavailable. So I'm really really grateful to him. And then also the Navy Wings charity, which also, that's another point actually, Navy Wings has copies of the book, so you can buy them from Navy Wings and also support that fantastic charity. So yeah, that's just get a plug in there. I was able to talk to Lieutenant Commander Chris Gotka, who's the who was the CO there, about things like the differences between flying a Seafire and a Sea Fury. So he's flown the Kennet Aviation Seafire Mark 15.
Yeah.
And so getting his insights into what those two aircraft are like to fly and how they compare with each other was really good. Really sort of interesting insight into to sort of how a really experienced warbird pilot approaches them. So I just sort of tried to take information from wherever I could find it, and try and encapsulate the story of the aircraft in a way that it perhaps hasn't quite been done before. I mean, it is an aircraft that a lot has been written about. There is some new stuff that I've dug out in this book. It's not like, say, the Barracuda and Skua, where big chunks of it hadn't really been told before. There is some insights in there that I've found that are will add something to the story. And also just trying to find a good set of photographs to illustrate them, which I think that's as big a part of it. Picture tells a thousand words, as is often said. So trying to find photos that aren't of Seafires crashing on deck, which at one point I was beginning to think that half the photos in the book were going to be crash examples, but we managed to find some that were that were of other aspects of its career.
Okay, and then one final question on the Seafire, Matt. Talk about it. I mean, in the terms of Fleet Air Arm legends, but what would you say its legacy was for the Fleet Air Arm?
Well, I think its legacy was filling the breach when there was nothing else available, and at the point where the Fleet Air Arm needed a high performance fighter for it to be able to go and take the war to the Axis powers in North Africa, in Italy, and in the Pacific, there was nothing else available that could do the job. It's the story really of an aircraft that, it's like the typical Fleet Air Arm story of having to work with something that's not ideal and then doing far more with it than anyone ever appreciated. So it's like the Blackburn Skua, it's like the Sea Harrier, it's like those other aircrafts like the Swordfish. It's like you start with something that's really, you look at it and you think, how on earth are you going to put that thing on a carrier deck?
Yeah.
And the Fleet Air Arm found a way, and it enabled them to take the war back to the enemy and to help them make those invasions in mainland Europe and the pushing on through the Pacific make that a success.
Yeah.
And so I think that's very much its legacy.
Okay, so the book's available now from all great places. Where's the best place to get it from? Published by Morton Books?
Yeah, so it's Morton's Books and it's their Tempest Books imprint. So you can buy it direct from the publisher if you go to the Morton's website. It's mortonsbooks.co.uk anyway, and it's actually on their homepage.
Yeah, wonderful.
And also, as I say, have a look at Navy Wings because their online shop stocks it, and it would be great to support Navy Wings. They do a fantastic job, and obviously one of their associate aircraft is the Kennet Aviation Seafire Mark 17, which is a fantastic aircraft. And when the air show scene gets going again, it'll be great to see that in the air. So you can support Navy Wings and buy the book at the same time, because because I know some people have had trouble getting the book because of COVID and the supply chain issues, but things are starting to open up now, and so it's the book's a bit more available than it was. It kind of came out at the worst possible time.
Okay, Matt, thanks for that. Where can we find you online?
My website is nivellairhistory.com, and that's a sort of blog with lots of articles about naval aviation. I'm on Twitter at Naval Air History. I'm on Facebook, and my Facebook page is called Air and Sea Stories.
Matt, just before I let you go, there's always something interesting in the Willis pipeline. Any sneak previews of what might be coming up that you're working on?
I've mentioned the Fairy Firefly a few times today, but there will be a book on the Firefly coming out at some point, I hope in the not too distant future. Then we've got Morton's Legends of the Fleet Air Arm, with a second book on the Fairy Swordfish. That's been, again, unfortunately, COVID sort of put paid to our plans for an immediate release on that, so that won't be out for a little while. We'll be looking towards the tail end of next year, but do keep an eye out for that one. Also, I've got a couple of articles on the Battle of Britain coming up in Aeroplane magazine. So that's their sort of special Battle of Britain issue, which should be coming out fairly soon, including one on Coastal Command. So Coastal Command 16 group within the Battle of Britain. So I think that's quite an interesting and relatively untold story, which I think people might be interested in.
Thanks, as always. Absolutely fascinating stuff. Thanks for your time today.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
Okay, that's it. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. We'd also like to thank Mick Oakey and the team at the Aviation Historian for helping to promote the programme. If you've enjoyed this episode or want to comment on the show, please give us some feedback on your app, our Facebook page, or Twitter. You can always email us at getinvolved@aviation-extended.co.uk. And just remember, no leading E on the word extended. You can find Extended on all the popular podcast players, including Apple, Google, Stitcher, Player, and Podbean. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, and please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme is produced with a Creative Commons licence. You can find Tim Robinson at @RAESTimR on Twitter. You can find Gareth at @Gareth_Stringer on Twitter. And of course, you can always find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter and on our Facebook page. So that's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extended!
is XTP Media.